So good morning, everyone. It's so nice to see all of your beautiful faces. Thank you so much for the warm introduction. And your presence here indicates to me that you too are passionate about the work that the Jubilee Fund does in poverty reduction. And I thought today that I would do something that, quite frankly, I've never done before. And that is share a little bit about my personal history in a public way, which is a little unnerving for me. But I think it's important because it will explain how I arrived here, why this work isn't just a job to me. It's much, much more than that. So I was born in a little town in northwestern Manitoba, Swan River. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. My family actually lived in Birch River, so a community just north of Swan River. And my Indigenous heritage comes from my paternal grandfather. And my, maternal grandfather. My paternal grandparents were Ukrainian and Polish, and very staunch Catholics. They were the first generation of Canadian-born family members. My mom had a large family, as did my father. My mom had four brothers, three sisters, and my dad had five brothers and five sisters, but unfortunately, one of his sisters died in infancy. And by Western standards, they were extremely impoverished people, really had nothing. When I think about that, and think about where we are here today, the fact that I can enjoy this venue, it really gives me a pause. It makes me stop and think about where I came from. My dad recounted stories of when he was a little boy. His job in the family household was cooking. And he recalled being a little boy, 5, 6 years old, standing on a milk crate at the stove, cooking for his family. And he said to me, "You know, Shanley, there's that expression about eating crow." We really did. At times when food was scarce, that was a meal that they prepared. And my mom, too, recounted what it was like for her as a child and how my granny, because there wasn't enough food to go around, would just take little bites off each child's plate. Sometimes they would each get an egg, and her meal would be a bite of that egg. And there was never any complaining, never. My mom said she didn't realize that they were poor, because it was never made evident to her. When I was little, my maternal grandparents lived in a small town, Cranberry Portage, in northern Manitoba. They lived close to the lake. And they lived in what they lovingly referred to as the little shanty. It was a four, I'm being generous, room home. No running water, a cook stove. And that place was a place that was full of love. I have still fond memories when I smell the smell of cinnamon. My granny made cinnamon buns. She baked bread and she made the most delicious cookies. And I still don't know how, really, because when you think about the ingredients that are required by my standards today, and I don't make anything near as good as hers, she didn't have all of those things. So how that was possible is still beyond me. And that was the same house that my mom spent most of her childhood in. My granny would go down to the lake and she would haul water from the lake. And she had rain barrels in the yard and collected the rain. And that's how she washed, did laundry, cooked, cleaned, and supported the needs of the household. And I think about that, and I think about how there's many First Nations today that still don't have running water, but how lucky I am. We had an experience one day at work where they were doing work on the infrastructure, and the water got turned off just for a few hours. Health and safety came right away and said what an unsafe work environment it was because there was no flush toilets for about 2 hours. We had bottled water. And, you know, I mean no disrespect, but I felt a little irritated because I was thinking about my relatives in communities, like I said, where they've never had running water. And here we were put out for a couple of hours, and that was a big deal. Just getting back to my grandparents, I want to talk a little bit about my paternal grandparents as well. As I mentioned, that they lived in the same community as I did, Birch River, Manitoba. They lived on a farm, in a little old farmhouse. And similarly, the same situation as my mom's parents, they really had nothing. Food was scarce even when I was a child. But I also never knew that, because when I went to my Bob and Guido's house, there were pierogies, there were cabbage rolls, there was borscht. They grew a garden, and they made the best of all of their efforts, harvesting that food, and it was beautiful. So those memories that I had as a little girl, really reinforced something important to me, which is kind of going to be a segue a little bit into the presentation that I'm going to provide later. That it isn't just about material things. Really, poverty is more than that. And see, I didn't feel like I lived in poverty because I felt safe. I felt like I had a community that I belonged to, and I felt loved. When I was about two, I got really sick. I developed pneumonia, and I had to be hospitalized. And weirdly enough, in those days, it wasn't like it is now, where you would go to the hospital and spend that time with your kids. That tells you how old I am. But my mom had to take me, and she had to leave me. So I was in the hospital by myself for a couple of weeks. And I have memories of that, which is also kind of surprising to me, but I guess it's because of feelings that I experienced during that time. It was scary. I had a really high fever. I was immersed in what I remember as being these big metal vats. And truthfully, all it was a bathtub, but it seemed really big to me in my little body to cool my temperature. And then my mom was able to finally pick me up, but that experience impacted me. More about that later. Shortly after my recovery, we relocated. We went to Thompson, Manitoba. I'm sure many of you have had the experience of going to the north. And I would say that living in the north is like no place else on earth. That's where I learned a true sense of community. Because when you're in an environment that's remote and cut off, really, from many other supports and services, you have to learn to rely on one another. You have to learn to be a good neighbor. And that's something that I learned. I was living there at the time when the mine was booming, though. So it was a different Thompson than it is today. And it was a time when it was mostly young people, young families, young men working in the mines. And I think kind of an interesting story. I was in elementary school, and one of my schoolmates, her grandparents came from another country to visit. And it was big news at Westwood Elementary School because we didn't usually see elderly people. So we literally, a group of us, went to see the elders because it was important. Yeah, I'm one of those elders now. So the health conditions that I developed when I was a little girl kind of worsened in my early years in Thompson, and then they continued to get worse. I faced many near-death experiences, had to travel across Canada to receive treatment. And why that matters in the context of poverty is because my family couldn't afford it. It wasn't treatment that was covered by Manitoba Health, and we didn't have the resources for the travel nor the treatment. So we had to rely on community members and family and friends to help support that. And I am eternally grateful to this day, so grateful for the spirit of generosity that exists in community. During my childhood, my dad, he suffered with addictions, alcoholism. And that really impacted our family. I think some of the reasons for his addiction actually stemmed from my first comment about the family being staunch Catholics. My dad went to Catholic school. And unfortunately for him, he was left-handed. And when you were left-handed in those days, it wasn't okay. He was beaten because he was told that it signified that he had the devil in him. And I think that those experiences were profoundly traumatic. And I believe that that was, in many respects, why he turned to alcohol. Later in his life, he said he just didn't feel like he fit in, that he was okay. And somehow that liquid courage made him, for a few moments at least, feel like he belonged. So it wasn't easy growing up. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of uncertainty in my home. But one thing I will say about my dad that I am so grateful for and really speaks to his character, he always worked. He worked so hard and often held down more than one job to try and bring in enough for our family. And you know, despite those challenges, I had a close relationship with him. Very close relationship. Out of my siblings, I would say I was the one that really wanted to spend time with him. He taught me important things. He taught me how to hunt. He taught me how to fish. We went berry picking, mushroom picking. I learned which mushrooms were poisonous. Those were important lessons. And I also, my first day at kindergarten, because again, living in Thompson, I needed mitts. My dad hand-knit me mitts to wear to school. So that was really great. Those experiences were meaningful, and they shaped me. We moved back to Swan River when I was probably about 12, 13 years old. And those years, also challenging for many reasons, but they were good years. It was coming home. It was coming back to community. And there, that sense of belonging, although I felt that in Thompson, I felt it in a much deeper way, I think, when we returned home. And I was able to complete high school despite my health problems, and then I relocated here to Winnipeg. And I met a man who I would later marry and would be the father of my oldest daughter. And unfortunately, that relationship was a difficult relationship, a very abusive relationship. And so I ultimately left. While we were married, we moved to BC, we moved to Alberta. I felt very isolated. So as soon as our relationship ended, I came back to Manitoba. And my parents' marriage ended shortly after mine did, which was a weird thing for me. It was I would say in many respects, more difficult than my own breakup. My subsequent relationship several years later, probably like 7 or 8 years later, was actually even worse than my marriage was. My ex-partner was an alcoholic, but he also had a drug problem. So the violence was at a much increased level. And it made me really question myself, my self-worth, why I wasn't good enough. What did I do wrong? And in an effort to prove that I mattered, that I was something, that I was okay, I went to college while working 3 jobs and raising my oldest daughter, which is crazy. But by Western standards, that addiction that I had, that I was a workaholic, that somehow is acceptable. Crazy. So things reached the point of no return in my relationship shortly after my second daughter was born. I had been life flighted to Winnipeg. I had to spend about a month there before she was born. And that was really hard for me, being away from my family, the people I knew, and dealing with the situation in my relationship at that really, really vulnerable time for me. So after my beautiful little baby was born, her dad decided he was going to celebrate the birth of the baby. And I'm talking hours after she was born. He promised me that he would be back in the morning, though, because we were supposed to leave at 7 a.m. You can imagine that I was not terribly confident that that was going to be the case, but I was trying to be hopeful and optimistic. So the next morning arrived, and he wasn't there. And hours passed, and more hours passed, and I made calls, and nobody knew where he was. He eventually did show up around dinner time, and he looked at me like I was crazy for being upset, and said that he lost the car. In his drunken state, he didn't know where it was, but he eventually found it, so lucky for us, we were gonna be able to go home. But of course, I didn't want him to drive my newborn, precious baby in that state. Really, that was the beginning of the end. I had really reached my breaking point at that time, and I asked him to leave. I had to return to work less than 6 months after my baby was born because I wasn't able to support my family. I couldn't make ends meet. He was not contributing anything. We were living in a mobile home at that time. And just several months after that, I had a flood in my home. And it totally destroyed the home. It was inundated with mold and unlivable. But I had nowhere to go. My mom was living in Manitoba housing at the time, and they have pretty stringent rules. So she said to me, I'm going to go to them. I'm going to plead your case. I'm going to ask if you can live here at least temporarily with me. So that's what happened. And you know, the reason I'm saying this is I just want to really focus on the gratitude that I had. Those were not normal things. Manitoba housing typically doesn't allow that. I was lucky. I was lucky. And my mom embraced us. My girls had their grandmother. It was a good situation. And the stark reality is I was going to be homeless. You know, all of these experiences have had a profound impact on me, obviously. I now have a really deeper understanding of trauma, intergenerational, precognitive, developmental, and acute trauma. I know that trauma creates a very false or deficient sense of self. That's what I experienced. Because in a physiological way, it affects our prefrontal cortex. It causes us to react rather than respond. And the things that we experience in our childhood, the trauma we experience, it actually imprints on us in our nervous system. We often end up playing out the very relationships that we witnessed, that we experienced. And that is exactly what I did. Not once, but twice. And again, although I was lucky, because I didn't end up suffering from an alcohol or drug addiction, my workaholic problem was a problem. It impacted me, and it impacted my children. My career has been a diverse career, but it's always been in human services. I started out in the disability field, and then I transferred into child welfare with a focus on sexual exploitation. That is one hard gig, because your heart cannot be not be impacted by those experiences, those things that our beautiful young men and women endure. So because my girls were little at that time, and I could see them in those experiences, I did have to step away because I was starting to see the world really differently. My worldview was shifting. I was seeing dark and hopelessness all around me, but that's not true. There is beauty, but I forgot to be intentional to look for the beauty. So I had the privilege of working at the Manitoba Métis Federation, and I see a colleague in the room today. I worked in economic development and I worked in health. The economic development projects that I worked on were from the standpoint of for benefit. I don't know who's familiar with that concept, but really just not just about making money, but using those resources to give back to the community. That was an honor. But my heart never left the kids. And so now that my daughters are growing, beautiful women that I'm proud of, I was able to come back to the work that I love. And Ndinawe, Maganag, Endawad, Ojibwe for our relatives' home, I feel like I've truly come home. I'm back where I belong. In May of 2021, that's when I received my appointment as executive director. And I would say that that's probably one of the greatest honors that I've ever had. You know, our model is very different. It's not a Western model. It's an Indigenous model of kinship and caring. And so the people that I sit with at our table, at work, they're my sisters, they're my brothers. And that's how we approach our work. We view our children that we support, our children and youth, they are our family. They are my relatives. And so it's not a job. It's our responsibility, and it's an honor, and I will never forget that. Ndinaway has a strong history. It's history that started well before my arrival. For 30 years, Ndinaway is providing services to youth in our community in the North End. I think the birth of Ndinaway, though, that to me is a tragedy. And the reason it's a tragedy is it because things haven't changed to the point they should have yet. So back in 1990, there was a horrific case. It was called the Krantz case. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. There was a person by the name of Edward Krantz that had grossly and violently exploited young women, all of whom were Indigenous. And that exploitation was a trade for food and shelter. How disgusting is that? So it was that media attention, the publicity that was brought to that case, that caused our community just to come together. They said, enough, we're not having this. We're gonna take care of our own. And so the Ndinaway Safe House was born in 1993. And since then, Ndinaway has expanded services. We have a second stage facility which provides independent living supports to youth. It's called Chumanitu Tonka Awatitipi. Big Wolf Nation lives here. I think it's a beautiful name. We also had the Youth Resource Center on Selkirk Avenue. And after the tragic demise of our dear little sister, Tina Fontaine, her family gifted us that name. And we do our best to honor her memory by the services that we provide there. And we also have the privilege of a partnership with Red River College, and we offer the first year of the Child and Youth Care Certificate Program. It's for experiential men and women that want to take a course, and their path has directed them to provide youth care supports in our community. And the thing that I love most about it, Ndinaway, is that it's true to who we are as people. Culture isn't a program or service. That's what we get often in other non-Indigenous youth serving organizations. And please, no disrespect, we're all doing really good heart work and hard work. But our kids need to know who they are. They need to know where they belong. They need to know that they're loved and they're part of something. They're part of a community. So I'm really proud of that. And that's kind of my segue to poverty reduction through Mino the Madziwin. And you might wonder, well, how is that different than anything that we've already tried? I hope that I can demonstrate that as we go through the presentation. So you're probably wondering, for those of you that do not know Ojibwe, what does it mean? And it means the good life, the good life. And if you think about what is a good life, from our perspective, it's about a holistic way of living. We can't focus on one aspect of who we are. We have to focus on a holistic approach. So that means it starts with us in our minds, our thoughts. Our minds are very powerful. And if our minds and our words and our actions are misaligned, that's a problem. We'll never achieve the good life. So similarly, interventions that are geared towards addressing poverty, it can't focus on one thing. It can't just focus on material things. It's not going to be successful. And I often think that that's maybe why we're still in the situation that we're in now. Because we're taking the wrong approach. Next slide. I thought this was a profound statement. Nancy Hudson is she's an author. She's done a lot of work. She's from Colorado. She's a writer. And it resonated with me. She said, poverty is more than income level. It is a socially constructed identity that leaves scars of psychological impoverishment. And I would say that that is the harder part to get over. I'm not alone. I'm sure many of you in this room have also had times when you didn't have what you needed from a material sense. And then when those needs were met, it's not like everything was magically good, because psychologically, we're still impacted by those experiences. So now I want to speak about, obviously, Indigenous people in poverty. The majority of youth that we support at Nidinawe are Indigenous. And if you look at the statistics in our province, that is true as well. And please don't think I'm trying to take anything away from the experiences of other groups that are non-Indigenous. That is not my intent. But my job is to support the people that are my community members. So that's what I'm going to speak to. So, next slide. Because the word poverty doesn't really exist in any Indigenous language, what I'd like us to do is consider the opposite of Minu Bemadzawin. Look at it from the reverse perspective or inverse perspective. Poverty was a foreign concept. It wasn't something that existed before colonization. And it has been constructed through the colonial process. When you think about what happened to Indigenous peoples, their lands, their resources, their economic practices, the way that they conducted life and business, that all changed. The way they governed themselves, that was stripped away. They weren't allowed to practice, to be who they truly inherently are. And we know the effects of residential schools, the 60s scoop. We've been hearing so much about it. But I think sometimes what we forget is that is still continuing through the child welfare system. It is the most colonial of colonial practices. I had the honor of sitting at a table where we were talking about time in care, extension of time in care, and trying to move that age limit. And there was a wonderful man who was part of that group that was from another country, an African country. And he said, I don't understand. I don't understand what you do here. And he said, in my country, this would never be allowed. We take care of our own. And the truth is, as Indigenous peoples, we did the same thing. But from a Western standpoint, things like not having enough food were reasons for children to be taken from their homes. To be brown-skinned was a reason to be taken from your home. That's not okay. Indigenous peoples also have a very different view than Western society about what true success means. And it's not that we don't recognize the need to have material possessions. We too need food, we need a roof over our heads, we need those things. But it's not enough. It's not enough. And really being able to be our true, authentic selves, having our sovereignty over our own decision-making, honoring the treaties that were created, because they sure didn't turn out to be what Indigenous people thought they were going to be, having the autonomy to make decisions, and also the protection of the land. Those relationships to the land are so important. We also recognize that just by pursuing wealth, if we sacrifice who we are, if we sacrifice our identity, our culture, we're just as impoverished as if we have no money. Those are not the priorities. Going back to Minu Bemadzawin, holistic, balance, harmony. So well-being includes taking care of the earth too. Another really important part about an Indigenous worldview is we're not egocentric or individualistic. Our focus is on the collective, the greater good. And in communities, back before colonization, everyone had a meaningful contribution that they made. Their gifts, their abilities, their talents were recognized, not so that they could honor themselves, but for the good of community. Next slide. I'm not going to go into these stats. I thought it was important to show them, but I'm not going to review them. Instead, I'm going to share experiences that reflect these stats. And you'll see that the title is called Areas of Focus, and the F on the side, that represents focus, but what more importantly it represents is failure. We have failed. I'm not even sure we deserve an F in all of those areas, but that's as good as it is. So youth homelessness, it's disgusting is really the only word I can use. At Tina's Safe Haven, we have a safe space for youth where we accept anyone within our age mandate, which also is problematic for us. But youth between the ages of 11 and 24 can come to Tina's Safe Haven and then be welcomed. The thing is, at my table, I have the honor of sitting with some beautiful women from Native Clan. We know that when our youth are released from the justice system, they often are, they have nowhere to go. So now we've become the place, the drop-off. I also have a sister from the WRHA sitting at our table. Sometimes when kids are discharged from the hospital, they're dumped off. I'm using that word intentionally, dumped off at our front door. Not handed off, not how can you help, they're dumped off there. That isn't a home. We create a loving, welcoming environment, but everybody deserves a place to call home that truly is theirs. We fail. We fail as a society. Exploitation, you know, I spoke about the Krantz case. I would like to say that since 1990, huge strides have been made with the issue of exploitation, but I'd be lying if I said that. I'm scared when my baby, 19 years old, so I guess she probably wouldn't love to be called a baby, but she is my baby. When she goes out, I will never allow her to take a taxi, never. And when she takes an Uber, it's tracked. And that happens every time she goes out. I can't sleep till she's home because the reality is that our women are taken. They're taken, they're exploited, they're killed, and they end up in the landfill. And I don't want that to be my baby. Mental health issues are so profound and pronounced and exacerbated by the drug addiction issue. Substances are not like they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's awful. But what's even more terrible is our children and youth are denied services. They're denied services. I'm going to tell you a story about the Crisis Response Center. And again, this is only coming from a place of reality. It's not coming from a place of judgment. A young person that was in mental health crisis, suicidal, and begging for help, was taken to the Crisis Response Center. That same young person had been there previously, and in their dysregulated state, had broken a window. A window. And were denied services because they were too much of a risk. We don't have the capacity to support people like that, was what I was told. People like that. Dysregulated, traumatized youth because of the very things that our systems have imposed. Disgusting. Next slide, please. Family breakdown. You know, many of our youth, as I said, were stripped away from their families. They don't even know what community they come from. They don't know whether they're First Nations or Métis. They don't know. That's a reality. They long for those familial connections. So that's what we try to provide for them at Nadinawe. And similarly with education, our kids don't fit in mainstream schools. So we have to do things differently. And I feel very blessed. We have a partnership with CETA, the Winnipeg School Division, and Mum Away. We have an off-campus school where youth that just can't manage in the traditional school system have the opportunity to get an education, because we have to do things their way and meet them where they're at. Similarly with health challenges, the stats on health of Indigenous people are horrible, even at a very, very young age. I guess my own experience is reflective of that. And they are also denied services when they go to the hospital or the clinic. They are racially profiled and labeled before they get through the door. The assumption is that they're there to get drugs. That's the assumption. More times than not, that has to change. It has to change. And cultural connections are key. Again, if we don't know who we are, if we don't have an identity and feel a sense of belonging, we can never overcome our traumatic experiences. So that's where it starts. And I think Ndinawe and other organizations do a really good job of making sure that that's at the forefront. Next slide. I'm sure many of you have heard of the medicine wheel. Many of you maybe use that in your practices. And I thought the model really just kind of summarizes what I was speaking about earlier with respect to living the good life. The balance between all areas of our being are so important. Spiritual, physical, emotional, and mental. We can't prioritize one and forget about the other. So what have we learned from all of this? Next slide. We have to take a holistic approach to poverty reduction. We have to consider all dimensions. They're all interdependent. And we can only achieve well-being if we maintain balance. I wanted to close with the Lakota Instructions for Living. To me, this was I wish I was so articulate, and I'm not, but this to me is beautiful, and I love it. It says, friends, do it this way. That is, whatever you do in life, do the very best you can with both your heart and mind. And if you do it that way, the power of the universe will come to your assistance if your heart and mind are in unity. When one sits in the hoop of the people, one must be responsible, because all creation is related. And the hurt of one is the hurt of all. And the honor of one is the honor of all. And whatever we do affects everything in the universe. If you do it that way, that is, if you truly join your heart and mind as one, whatever you ask for, that's the way it's going to be. Miigwech. Thank you.